Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, welcome everybody. My name is Tanya Burkhardt. I'm an Associate Director in the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion and an Associate Professor in the Department of Social Policy here at LSE. You're all very warmly welcome here in the Hong Kong Theatre and also online. And I'm delighted to welcome the panel, who I will introduce in a moment, for this event on the case for the four-day week. I guess the central question that we're going to be asking this evening is whether workers, families, society, and maybe even employers could benefit from moving to a norm of a four-day week. Or would that cause the collapse of civilization as we know it? That's the kind of question that we're going to be tackling. We're going to be looking at the evidence, both in theory and in practice, for the effects of moving to a four-day week, and thinking about what would need to happen in order to make this change. So we've got 90 minutes, roughly speaking, to reach some answers and some solutions. And I hope you will enjoy and participate in that journey with us. So on my right here is Joe Ryle. He's director of the 4-Day Week campaign, so I guess you know where he's coming from. And he's also author of this fantastic handbook, which you will be able to purchase afterwards should you wish to. As well as being director of that campaign, Joe works as media and comms lead for the Autonomy Institute think tank. He was a former Labour Party press officer and formerly an advisor to John McDonnell when he was shadow chancellor. To Joe's right is Kirsten Zanebrook, who's British Academy Global Professor and Distinguished Policy Fellow at the International Inequalities Institute here at LSE. And she's an internationally recognised expert on job quality and employment conditions. And she will give a brief response after Joe has presented the case. And then on my left, I'm very delighted to welcome Fran Heathcote, who's General Secretary of the Public and Commercial Services Union, PCSU, one of the largest trade unions in the UK. And she's had that role since February 2024. Before that, she served as the union's president. And negotiating better employment conditions, including issues of work-life balance and working hours, is really part of Fran's bread and butter. So she's extremely well-placed also to comment on this issue. After we've heard from our panel, it'll be over to you in the room and online to ask your questions. Those of you who are online, you can use the Q&A function at any time during the first part of the session. Please add your name and affiliation, and Peter here in the front will be fielding those questions and selecting those that we can address in the Q&A session. In the room, you'll get a chance just to put your hand up and ask your question directly. The hashtag, if you're tweeting, can you still tweet on X? I'm not sure if you X on X, I don't know. Tweet, I think, is the right terminology. Hashtag LSE events. For today, and the session is being recorded, and barring any technical difficulties, will be made available as a podcast hereafter. Okay, well, without further ado, I have to hand over to Joe to introduce the case. Thank you.
Start a timer. Hopefully this will work. Okay. Hello, everyone. Good evening. So today, I'm going to be talking about a powerful concept, which is freedom. Imagine a world where workers reclaim 50% more of their lives, where a four-day week unlocks not just extra time, but also a path to happiness and fulfillment. By the end of this event today, I hope you'll be able to see how embracing this change can transform not just individual lives, but society as a whole. But I'd like to start by briefly stepping back in history for a moment. so we can better understand where today's movement for a four-day week actually comes from. Because it's almost exactly 100 years ago, virtually to the day, that everyone used to work 6 days a week, with Sunday reserved as the day for going to church. After a major campaign by the trade unions and some progressive businesses, the weekend was one for all workers between the 1920s and 1940s. One of the earliest pioneers was Ford Motor Company in the United States of America. In 1926, Ford became the first major company in America to adopt a 5-day, 40-hour week for workers in its factories. Hopefully this slide's going to work. Okay. Here's a quote from Edsel Ford. He's Henry Ford's son and the company's president. He said at the time, and again, this is 1926, every man, of course, every woman as well, every man needs more than 1 day a week for rest and recreation. We believe that in order to live properly, every man should have more time to spend with his family. Though workers' time at work was reduced, productivity and profits went up, and manufacturers all over the country soon followed Ford's lead. 100 years later, it's 100 years later, I really want to emphasize that, and the 9-to-5, 5-day working week still remains the dominant model of work across most of the world, despite the fact it was primarily designed for the industrial and agricultural economy we had at that time. According to the CIPD, over 60% of jobs today in the UK still operate using this 9-to-5, 5-day working week model. Since the 1920s and 1930s, the world of work has obviously completely transformed since then. No one can really argue against that. So why are we still working a very similar amount of working hours as we were 100 years ago? The 9-to-5, 5-day working week is outdated and it's no longer fit for purpose. And I just want to talk through some facts, which I think will be useful to highlight this. Since the 1980s, working hours in this country have barely reduced at all. Workers are a lot more productive than they were a few decades ago. Just think how quickly we can respond to emails on our phones, but hardly any of these productivity gains have been passed back to workers in the form of more free leisure time. We're long overdue a change here. When you take into account all of the additional labour added to the economy as a result of women joining the workforce in huge numbers, it's even more shocking. In the early 1970s, the female employment rate was 53%, but by 2023, as you can see here, it was 72%. But despite all of these extra hours being put in, working hours just haven't reduced accordingly. The next quote is from, I wanted to get David in here somewhere, he was a good friend of mine, David Graeber, who was a professor of anthropology at the LSE. And I think his quote comes in here quite nicely, because he wrote this famous essay, which I remember he published it online, it went completely viral, and the title of it was Bullshit Jobs. And he said, and I think this fits quite nicely here, it's as if someone were out there making up pointless jobs just for the sake of keeping us all working. And he also went on to write a book, and he sadly passed away in 2020. Now, this would all be much easier to accept if living standards were rising, but the opposite is happening. Living standards are falling. Although we're significantly more productive than in the 1980s, in the UK, we now work some of the longest hours in the world, and it's even worse when compared with other European neighbours. We work the longest full-time hours compared to nearly every country in the European Union, while at the same time, we have one of the least productive economies. So all these long working hours we're all putting in, they're not producing good results for workers, and they're not producing good results for the economy. What they are producing, however, is a workforce that where millions are burnt out, stressed, overworked. And we can see that by the millions of people who are currently out of work with both long-term and short-term sickness. To rub it in the UK, we also have one of the fewest number of bank holidays. Last few facts. According to the Health and Safety Executive, 18 million working days are lost every year as a result of work-related stress, depression, or anxiety. Furthermore, not to be too dramatic, but the World Health Organization has shown that long working hours are killing hundreds of thousands of people a year globally from stroke and heart disease. It's time for change, and we're long overdue more freedom from work. In 2022, we ran the biggest ever trial of a 4-day week to take place anywhere in the world so far. It involved 61 companies and nearly 3,000 workers, and the trials lasted for about 6 months. Hopefully you heard about it in the news. There was quite a lot of media coverage about it, and I think it's funny because we speak to journalists all the time, and I think partly the reason it's in the news all the time is because journalists themselves are desperate for a 4-day week. I hear them say it to me quite a lot on the phone. But 4-day week, you know, whenever any journalists publish any story in the 4-day week, we're always told it's one of their best read stories. There's clearly an appetite out there. I came up with the idea for running a big sort of trial in the UK after speaking on a panel at another event in London. I remember it quite well. I was challenged by a businessman at this event. It was a business conference. And he pointed out, you know, at the time there wasn't actually that much evidence that the four-day week actually works here in the UK. And I remember thinking, and I remember the conversation very well, I remember thinking, you know what, fair enough, he's got a point. You know, I'd pointed out that other countries like Iceland and others had already done a four-day week, but he said that doesn't necessarily mean those benefits will apply here to the UK. But after that event, I wanted to set out to prove that it could work here in the UK. One of the most exciting elements of the pilot for me was the fact that all the companies taking part came from a really diverse range of sectors. We had retail, manufacturing, healthcare, financial services. We even had a brewery and a fish and chip shop. So what were the results? At the end of the trial, remarkably, almost every single company decided to continue for a four-day week. 92%. Of the 61 companies that participated, at least 56 decided to continue. But let's have a look at the full results by dividing them into two parts, the impact on workers and the impact on employers. Turning first to the impact on workers. There was a 71% reduction in burnout for the workers that took part in that pilot. 39% of employees were less stressed. Reported levels of anxiety, fatigue and sleep issues decreased. Workers found it easier to balance work with family and social commitments. The time that men spent, this is quite an interesting one, the time that men spent looking after children increased by more than double that of women, which I think just proves the positive impact we could have for gender equality. Finally, there were also significant reported improvements in life satisfaction. And for me, this is the most important bit, you know, because ultimately the four-day week is about giving everyone the freedom to be able to live happier and more fulfilled lives. So I was really pleased with those results. So we know it works for workers, and these results back up pilots that have taken place all over the world, you know, in lots of different countries. But let's look at the impact on the employers, because it was just as encouraging. The vast majority of companies were satisfied that business performance and productivity was maintained, and in some cases even improved. The companies found that their revenue rose by 1.4%, compared to the 6 months before, and going back a year further, it was 35%. So these companies are making more money under a four-day week, more profitable. There was a 65% reduction in the number of sick days, and there was a substantial decline, 57% in the likelihood that an employee would quit. So huge benefits in terms of job retention, job recruitment, and companies also reported an improved ability to hire new workers. On this last point on job retention, job recruitment, because it's a big issue at the moment in the economy, just want to turn to Atom Bank, who are one of the UK's largest four-day week employers. I think they have 550 staff. When they moved to a four-day week, and you can see this headline here, from I think it was in the Times, they saw a rise in job applications by 500% in just 3 months after moving to a four-day week. I think that does just go to show how popular it has become with workers, because in survey after survey, workforce survey after workforce survey, it consistently comes out on top as the change in the workplace that workers want to see most. So to sum up the pilot, the results show that moving to a four-day week can be a win-win for both workers and for employers. Now I want to address the point here about a four-day week being counterintuitive, because I do understand that on the face of it, sometimes it can seem counterintuitive, that working less hours on the same pay can result in greater productivity. But there's already mounting evidence that proves this hypothesis. The first thing to say is that rested workers are better workers. We know that from the hundreds and hundreds of four-day week companies that now exist in Britain. But adopting a four-day week isn't just about doing the exact same work in 4 days rather than five by working harder or working faster. The four-day week is an opportunity to work smarter, not harder. It's about reprioritising work and deprioritising work and hyper-focusing on the outputs rather than the amount of hours worked. And as we've found running various pilots, there are various methods that can be utilised to improve business performance to make a four-day week a reality. Now, I'm just going to turn briefly to the personal side of it. You know, as someone who's enjoyed working a four-day working week for about 6 or 7 years now, I think, just want to talk briefly about the difference it's made on my life. I started out in the world of work at 18, like everyone else, and I was just so quickly struck by this lack of balance that working 5 days a week gives you. It doesn't leave anywhere near enough time for all the other things you want to do in your life. And, you know, I've been lucky to work in jobs that I've largely enjoyed most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time. But having 5 of your 7 days in this world at work is too much. There's not a good balance. I don't have kids. I don't know how parents make it work. I also found that in particular jobs that were really busy and really hectic, my sense of self-identity was also lost because of it was so attached to work. Your sense of self-identity outside of work becomes lost because you're so attached to your work. And I think that needs to change. At the moment, on my four-day week, I'm learning Portuguese. I've always wanted to learn a language. There's so much we could be doing on our extra day off. whether that's volunteering our community, you know, getting to know each other better. So many hobbies that we don't have the time for. Working a four-day week has also made me a lot more focused and efficient at work. When I come back into the office on a Monday morning, after a three-day weekend, I'm a lot more motivated for work, and there's no amount of money that I'd ever take to go back to working 5 days a week. Why would I ever give up that freedom? This quote from a CEO of one of the companies that took part in our pilot, I think sums up what I'm saying perfectly, better than me, actually. When you realise that day has allowed you to be relaxed and rested and ready to absolutely go for it on those 4 days, you start to realise that to go back to working on a Friday would feel really wrong. Stupid, actually. I agree. The overwhelmingly positive trial results mirror results seen all over the world, including countries like Iceland. Alongside this, many more companies are beginning to trial and adopt a four-day week. Most notably, Unilever in New Zealand and Australia, Panasonic in Japan, and Bolt in America, and Kickstarter in America, and Atom Bank here in the UK. In England, we now also have the first four-day week council in South Cambridgeshire, again, with overwhelmingly positive results. I won't go into these in too much detail because I don't want to bore you with too many facts, but here's some of the headlines from that trial, which is now a year and a half long, and you may again have read about it in the news because there was some controversy around it, and the previous Conservative government were attacking them and saying, how dare you do this? How dare you risk kind of taxpayers' money in this way? But actually, the irony of it is that they saved taxpayers' money. You know, staff turnover fell by 39%, and they saved at least £370,000 in just a year, mostly on agency staff costs, which is a huge issue throughout the public sector at the moment. I think the reason the council initially decided to do the trial was because they were losing £2 million a year on agency staff costs. They just couldn't fill the gaps that they've got. They couldn't recruit. And already, they started with the kind of office-based workers, and then they moved to the rest of the council. And even the bin truck drivers are now doing four-day week as well. And they had some particular job vacancies they couldn't recruit for years. 3 or 4 years they were just unrecruited for. And as soon as they moved to the four-day week, recruited for them straight away. Of the 24 kind of key performance indicators, KPIs, that measure the council's performance, virtually all of them either improved or stayed the same, with 11 measures performing better during the trial. Looking at planning applications, they decided quicker, key planning application decisions completed within the correct timescale. The time taken to process changes to housing benefit and council tax benefit claims fell. And there's been the main thing, you know, no increase in complaints from residents. Residents have not noticed any difference to their service. Support for a four-day week is now higher than it ever has been. Polling consistently shows that more than two-thirds of the public support such a move. It's very popular across the board, wherever you are in the country, wherever age you are, whatever income bracket you have. And that consistently comes through in all the polling. But when you break down the demographics even further, it's even more popular with young people. This is because my generation and the generation below me do not want our lives to be defined by work in the same way that we've seen it has been for our parents' and our grandparents' generations. But it's also because young people today have a raw deal. They are the first generation to experience a reduction in their quality of life compared to their parents. It's incredibly unfair that a young person living in London today has very little chance of getting on the housing ladder without getting help from their parents. The private rented sector is extortionate, travel is expensive, youth centres have been closed down, and going to university now gets you into £50,000 worth of debt. Given this context, we should not be surprised that young people today have zero enthusiasm for working 5 days a week. There are many, many, many benefits to a four-day week, and to summarise, here are just a few of the main ones. Improved work-life balance, improved productivity, reduced carbon footprint, because when people have more free time, we're much more able to engage in environmentally sustainable behaviours. Better employee recruitment and retention, increase in gender equality, decrease in unemployment, more time to spend in our communities, and more time to participate in local democratic institutions. If you're not convinced by now, then one of the final things I want to say is that artificial intelligence, AI, could mean a four-day week is inevitable anyway. With more automation and new technology on the way, moving to a shorter working week is going to be a necessity for sharing a diminishing amount of work more equally across the economy. If ChatGPT can do half of our jobs, then we should all benefit with more free time. So rather than being scared of AI taking away all of our jobs, a shorter working week could allow us to embrace this new technology. But at the end of the day, the four-day week is ultimately a choice about what kind of society we want to live in. It's a choice about how much we prioritise our work or how much we prioritise the rest of our lives. Do we want to continue on this path of busyness, overwork, and with little sense of our community around us? Or can we step back, slow down, and give ourselves the freedom to be able to focus more on the joy, community, and companionship that we all seek in our lives? That's not to say that joy can't arise at work, but it's usually love, family, friendship, community, and nature that offers true joy. If we can do all of this whilst not sacrificing productivity, then what have we got to lose? Just imagine how much happier we'd all be if we had a three-day weekend every single week. Our culture today, where the dominance of working life takes precedence above everything else, has got to change. One of the questions I want to leave you with today is, why is being busy all the time seen as a badge of honour in today's society? This is surely a sign of an unhealthy culture, but there's hope that this is beginning to change. At the four-day week campaign, we are aiming for the four-day week to become the normal way of working by the end of this decade. But we don't need to just imagine a four-day week anymore, because it's already here, with hundreds and hundreds of businesses and tens of thousands of workers already living that dream. As campaigners, and I'll end here, we're determined to build on this so that everyone has the chance for a proper work-life balance, so that on a very basic level, there is enough time outside of work to be able to get our chores done, get our life admin done, but more importantly, to have the freedom to be able to properly enjoy our lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Joe. A lot of food for thought there. But before I let you have your go, audience, we're going to hear from Kirsten Zainbrook.
Thank you. Well, first of all, let me say that this is a really lovely book to read. It's well written, it's short, and it's very, very informative. So I do recommend it to everybody. So thanks, Joe, for that wonderful presentation. I'm going to start off with some general comments about the book and about the four-day week in general, and I'll move on to some specific comments afterwards, and I'll make two different types of comments. One is about the experiment itself, and then some comments about the wider implications. I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't ask certain questions, and so I'm going to do that. But first of all, before I say anything else, I would really like to congratulate Autonomy, Joe, his team, everyone who was involved in this study, because I have honestly never seen a study generate this much impact anywhere. So certainly not in the world of work, not really in areas of other social policy issues. It was just, they launched the study, and within a matter of days, my podcast feed filled up with all these podcasts about the four-day working week, and every single media outlet that I even looked at in multiple different languages in North America and South America, in Europe, here in the UK, in Asia, they were all talking about this experiment. So I really haven't ever seen impact like that. So many, many congratulations. You not only did a great job on the experiment itself, but you also did a fantastic job on the communication afterwards. And the book is a reflection of that. It's also probably the largest experiment I've ever come across that is specifically targeting working conditions and provides a solution to much of what ails us in today's labour market. And when Brendan Burchill, who is one of the academics who was involved in this study and who's a good friend and colleague of mine, when he first told me about this experiment, I was quite sceptical. I think he might have been a bit sceptical as well. But when we saw the results and when he presented the results, I personally was absolutely blown away, because the results really contained evidence that I hadn't expected. So that's some of what I was going to talk about. In particular, when I went to the launch events and talked to people involved, employers, workers, also the people doing the study, they were really positive about it. Even the academics were gushing. So that was a very nice sort of experience to take away from that. I think also the other thing that speaks for itself is the fact that most of the companies that implemented this, 92%, according to what Joe said, didn't move away from it, so they stuck with this four-day week experiment, which I think is an important reflection of how important it is in terms of its consequences. And also, as Joe mentioned, this is a very timely experiment, not just because of AI and technology that is changing our lives, but also because it feels relatively recent, although some people may have forgotten we did just go through COVID, which really, really changed the way we work. And as together, I think these two things are producing the most profound changes in our labour market that we have seen in a very, very long time. And if you add into that the fact that the workforce is ageing and that many businesses can't recruit workers, then we really have a very new situation if you add all of that together. And in addition to that, we all seem to be juggling more work and family commitments. We have a sandwich generation now taking care of children and elderly parents. And so this is really an issue that we have to address going forwards. Having said all of that, I'm going to start with a personal anecdote, which I think sums up why some people might question this, or certainly, you know, skeptic academics would ask these questions to start with. And this is the fact that it's very different if you're undertaking an experiment and including a few companies and several thousand workers to rolling something out on a national basis. So for many years, I lived in South America, in Chile, and I remember being surprised when I found that Chilean workers worked on Saturdays. And during the time when I was living there, there was a reform of the working week, which reduced the number of working hours from 48 to 45. But very crucially, that reform reduced the number of working days from 6 to 5. And many other Latin American countries at the time went through similar reforms. And as you can probably imagine, workers were incredibly happy about this, especially manual workers who tended to still work 6 days. Office workers worked 5 days. For them, this was a tremendous change. They suddenly had a free weekend. However, the cautionary tale is that after a relatively short period of time, this then became the new normal. And if I think back to how workers were working before this reform and compare to, you know, what I know about job satisfaction and other employment conditions in Chile today, then the indicators are relatively similar in terms of how stressed out people are, how hard they're working, and so on. So this is one of the key and rather depressing realities of life as a public policy maker, which is that you try to make reforms that improve people's lives, and then adaptive preferences kick in, people get used to this new normal, and at the end of the day, they don't particularly feel much better off. So one of the key things I think we need to address are the questions around this. With regard to the experiment itself, I think there are some very specific issues that it really highlighted and that I think are worth sort of thinking about. The first issue is that the results are incredibly positive and quite unexpectedly so. If you had told me beforehand that the sales of a fast food restaurant would increase as a result of the 4-day working week, I wouldn't have particularly believed you, but it seems to be the case. As workers are retained, more experienced, and enjoy their work more, they are more likely to ask you, and would you like fries with that? As a result of which, sales go up, and so these are some of the unexpected consequences that I hadn't bargained for. The other really important issue that the experiment, I think, highlighted, and we don't really talk about this very much in the policy realm, is that there seems to be still an awful lot of slack in the way we work. Presenteeism is still, it seems, more prevalent than we would normally imagine. We all know how much time we waste in meetings, and it seems to be a long time that we have really thought about our work processes and how they could become more efficient. And related to that point, of course, is the issue of productivity. So anyone who follows debates about the UK economy, but this is also a global issue, you hear a lot of complaints about the fact that productivity hasn't increased and that many countries and companies are looking for ways to increase productivity. And it strikes me that this could be one way of doing this, by rethinking work processes and making things more efficient. The other thing, and this was a result that I particularly enjoyed because I work on poor quality employment myself, and I have long been saying that we have too many short-term jobs, too many people rotating between jobs, too many people in really bad jobs, however you define that. And what this study really showed is that you save a lot of money from not having to permanently hire, recruit, train staff, that the cost of job rotation in our labour market is very, very high. And therefore, if you are implementing an experiment such as a four-day working week, and you have workers flock to you with their applications and then stay, that really shows you how much we are currently spending on a process that is, again, not very necessary or, in fact, actually costly. The other issue that I thought was very, very important and is worth highlighting is the reduced cost of negative, what we call as academics, negative externalities. So the lack of the lower rate of sick days, the lower rate of absenteeism, improved health, improved quality of life, all of those things seem to contribute to the fact that people then become more productive. And again, this is a hidden cost that we don't discuss and think about enough when we think about our labour markets. We know from previous research, especially in the field of management sciences, that happier workers are more productive, but somehow this never seems to filter into the public policy discourse. So if you look at the public policy discourse in recent years, people look at the labour market as a space where there's a trade-off between, you know, you increase wages, but it could generate more unemployment, it could reduce the quantity of work and so on. So we are so used to thinking about employment from this perspective of a dichotomy of, you know, you improve this, but then the cost will reduce or will produce something negative. And really what this experiment shows, one of its key contributions, is that we can produce win-win situations. And when we think about policy making, we don't really seek those out enough, and we certainly don't undertake reforms or policies with that in mind. The other thing is that the depressing cost of this flexibilisation that we have experimented in the labour market through things like outsourcing the labour force, agency work, that kind of thing. We tend to have used those to reduce the cost of labour, which has depressed, of course, the progress that we have made as a society in the labour market, and it's one of the big reasons why workers do not feel better off as a result of, you know, our productivity increases over the decades. So many people are feeling more precarious in the labour market. They're feeling more at risk of losing their jobs or at risk of, you know, not having enough hours or facing unpredictable employment conditions. There's a huge cost to this, and we don't calculate that cost in policy-making terms. So again, this is a really valuable study because it illustrates that we can become more productive or more profitable even, not necessarily by depressing the cost of labour or depressing employment conditions. We can achieve the same result or even a better result with a positive policy. So all of these points, I think, give us much food for thought. There is, of course, a but, and I wouldn't be standing here as an academic if I didn't highlight some of the issues. So the first thing, as I've already mentioned, is that working conditions in Europe, in the UK, everywhere around the world have changed very significantly. I'm one of the people who measures this. In the UK, for example, we've calculated that 1 in 4 jobs are of what we would describe as poor quality. In London, it's 1 in 3. And along with this trade-off that I mentioned before, this flexibilisation of the labour market has generated a way of distributing the available quantity of work. So that's how we get to this trade-off notion when it comes to, you know, making positive reforms in the labour market. We, until now, the sort of received wisdom has been that, you know, unemployment rates are relatively high and we don't want it to go up, so therefore, you know, we have to undertake reforms that flexibilise the labour market so that we generate more work. And really, since COVID, for the first time, we're in a situation, it's the first time certainly that I've been looking at the labour market, where people are talking about this shortage of labour supply, of labour force, countries where population ageing is really reducing the amount of workers available and who can be hired and so on. So this is actually a very new circumstance that I think policymakers haven't quite absorbed yet. And this flexibilization process that we've been through for decades really shows that this isn't a solution to this issue. But our economies have also changed. So moving from manufacturing to service sectors also means that people can be employed flexibly more easily. And as I mentioned, all of these shifts in technology, COVID and so on, have shown that things can actually happen also very quickly. So this four-day week experiment, I think, should be seen in conjunction with some of the work that's being done on AI and the future of technology, but also should be viewed in conjunction with the work that's been done on the COVID crisis, because that's the quickest change in how we work that has ever happened in the course of human history, as far as I can see. Now, one of the problems with all of this is that we don't monitor employment conditions very carefully. So if you think about your average labour force survey that measures the unemployment rate, wage levels, participation rates, etc., those surveys do not include a comprehensive battery of questions that are undertaken regularly about employment conditions. And the problem with this is that we are actually, when it comes to employment conditions, working conditions, and so on, we're operating in a bit of an information vacuum. We have some data, we've got a bit of data here, we've got a bit of data there, we don't ask these things frequently enough. We're no longer in the European Working Conditions Survey since Brexit. So our information on these issues is really very partial, and your experiment falls into that vacuum of data. And the problem with not having accurate data is that you can then, what tends to happen is that in that space, decisions or debates occur based on opinions and not evidence. And that, again, is where we are with regard to working conditions, job quality, and so on, not only in the UK, but worldwide. As a result of this, I would plead for more evidence on what exactly is going on, not just with this experiment, but also with employment conditions more broadly. So as I mentioned, one of the key questions is what would happen if we rolled out this experiment nationwide. So obviously workers are going to flock to you and apply more consistently. If there's one company that has a four-day working week, pays the same as the next one, which has a five-day working week, there's a tremendous impact from that. But if it were rolled out nationwide, then how would that change the impact? One of the ways in which you can satisfy academics, policymakers, and people undertaking these studies is to undertake rigorous behavioral economic studies that control for these changes. So, for example, as you mentioned, Joe, you have Unilever undertaking reforms in New Zealand and in Australia to implement a four-day working week, but not in other countries. So the key thing there is to compare the impact and the changes. Or if you have one council in the UK doing this and another not, you need to match these up scientifically to get really robust results, and then you will have a stronger argument going forwards for making these changes. There's also a lot of evidence in the literature from other reforms along these lines that have been undertaken in the past, reforms in multiple countries where the working week has been decreased, where as a result productivity has increased. So they provide evidence that shows how these have developed over the long run and also what happens when the whole economy does it. And I think a lot of this evidence would be actually beneficial to your study. The other idea that I had from reading your book is it would be really interesting to know more about the breakdown of savings that occurs in a company from a four-day working week. So you will have a proportion of savings or productivity increase or profit increase or whatever you want to call it that comes from not having to deal with this permanent job rotation, the permanent recruitment training and so on. You will have another proportion that will be a result of the reduced sick days, absenteeism and so on. And you will have, for example, another proportion that comes from increased sales. So again, if the experiment were rolled out at the national level, you won't have the advantage of being the one company that has a four-day week. Everyone would have it. And so it would be good to understand how these breakdowns are split up, what comes from which component, if that can be done. I'm on my last point. internationally, there's a lot of evidence that I've mentioned on precarious work. The key questions, so that there are a lot of inequalities that characterize our labor markets globally. We have good jobs, we have bad jobs, we have earnings inequality, inequality between different groups of workers in the labor market, and all of these intersect in different ways. So one of the key questions that I think this experiment raises is how would it interact with those groups of people? And would workers who are in poor quality employment and in precarious jobs benefit from this, or are they in situations that are so precarious that the first thing that they would do is go out and find a job for the day that they're not normally working? So I think there's a lot to be discussed in terms of how this would be rolled out if it were a national experiment, and how this would impact the labour market as a whole, and in particular the inequalities that we face every day in the labour market. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Well, I can feel Joe to my right just itching to get up and respond to some of those challenges that Kirsty has very helpfully laid out. But I'm going to keep you in your seat just for a few minutes longer, Joe, because I really want to hear from Fran Heathcote from PCSU.
Thanks so much. And just to echo Kirsten, I want to congratulate Jo on the publication of the book, the four-day week handbook, and clearly it's something that's generating a lot of interest. Jo and I shared a panel last month at the Labour Party conference where we organised a fringe meeting. Just to be clear, PCS isn't a Labour-affiliated union, but we do go along to Labour Party conference in order to articulate the issues that are sort of important to our members, and this was felt to be one where we could generate a good discussion, and in fact it was massively oversubscribed for the size of the room that we had. There were people queuing out the door to get in, and there was a huge amount of interest in it, not just from MPs but from Labour Party members from all sorts of walks of life. So I think that shows this is a really timely discussion that we're having, and I think as well that at this point in time, very much as Kirsten describes, the world of work has changed forever post-pandemic. You know, people are working differently. We're certainly having lots of dialogue with the new government about hybrid working and working differently and what that balance should be between your, you know, time in your office. Bear in mind that civil servants, you know, I know there's a sort of perception of bowler-hatted tea drinkers that sit around not doing very much, but actually the reality is that they work in hugely different sort of areas. So you take somebody in the Forestry Commission who spends half the time up a tree to somebody delivering benefits in the Department for Work and Pensions or dealing with taxation in the HMRC. So there are lots and lots of very different workplaces across the civil service. And unlike the previous government, who really didn't engage with us on any serious level, we have a lot of dialogue at the moment. And just as I made my way here tonight, albeit slightly late, I had a phone call from the Cabinet Office to say that they are now coming under pressure to put something out about how they view hybrid working and how they see the case for people coming back into the office. So you might remember Jacob Rees-Mogg and his post-it notes under the last administration, leaving them for our members saying, sorry, we missed you. And clearly we're glad to move away from that. But it's also at this time that the new government have just published aspects of the Employment Rights Bill. So the way that work changes, and Kirsten makes the points about precarious work, contracts and people working very differently. So I think this is a really timely discussion that we're having. And what I'm not going to do is make the academic case for a four-day week or even a moral case for it, because both can be made, but others on this panel will do that much better than I will. What I want to do as the General Secretary of the largest civil service union in the country, PCS, is to tell you about two groups of our members who have made this their industrial aim in their workplaces and how they've got gone about making that case to their employer. And clearly, you know, they're slightly different, the two cases, but I think we can learn some lessons around all of that. So one group of members is our members working in the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, better known as DEFRA or EFRA. And they work in quite a diverse range of roles. Some are office-based and some are quite literally, in some cases, out in the field. They're dedicated public servants whose role includes supporting agriculture, stewarding our environment and growing the UK's rural economy. They have worked for some time now, including alongside Joe and the four-day week campaign, to book together a serious case for a four-day week within their department. They've surveyed their members, held face-to-face meetings at workplaces across the country, and then presented that research to their management. From that research, we believe that the benefits include a happier, healthier workforce, lower staff turnover, improved productivity, and lower sick leave. And all of that has been evidenced in some of the research. Many of our members with caring responsibilities would also benefit from the shortening of the working week. And our members' research suggests that a four-day week would reduce sickness, absence and DEFRA by 65%, the equivalent of gaining 328 employees per year. We estimate for DEFRA and its partner organisations a four-day week could reduce turnover rates enough to save up to £21.4 million, roughly equivalent to DEFRA's flood defence budget for Northumbria, which is where I'm from, by the way. Alternatively, eliminating these turnover costs could fund the planting of 13 million trees annually. So this could be a win-win for workers and for the employer. It's perhaps unsurprising that when our members put the case under the last government, it was rejected. And going back to Jacob Rees-Mogg, just as an aside, if anybody remembers that glorious moment when he was condemning civil servants for working from home in a television interview, and the employer pointed out that Rees-Mogg was himself conducting the interview from his home, or in his case, from one of his many homes. But it's not just the change of government. There are some really well-reasoned arguments and campaigning pressure that is pushing things along now. And I'm really pleased to report that next month our union will formally engage in a discussion with DEFRA, who have now agreed to a formal dialogue between our reps and the employer about how we could take this proposal forward. And to be clear, DEFRA members are not asking for an immediate shift to a four-day working week, but rather that a pilot scheme be trialled to see how it could work in practice, identify any barriers that it creates, and looking at how those obstacles can be overcome. But it would not be the first pilot scheme in the public sector either, and that's the second group of PCS members that I want to talk to you about. At the beginning of the year, the Scottish Civil Service, working with Autonomy, launched a pilot 32-hour working week campaign involving 140 staff working at the South of Scotland Enterprise. It was initially a 12-month pilot with the potential for a wider rollout across Scottish Government if successful. A four-day, 28-hour week with no loss of pay, of terms and conditions has been long-standing a core element of the PCS Scottish devolved sector pay claim. In 2021, PCS Scotland, again working with the think tank Autonomy, to conduct a scoping project into the feasibility, desirability and impact of a four-day week in Scottish Government, working with other civil service unions and also with our non-members. The project found that 87% of workers supported the Scottish Government exploring the implementation of a four-day week, and 84% of workers said that they could adapt their work processes in order to suit a four-day week. The Autonomy and PCS report was shared with Scottish ministers and with MSPs. The four-day week featured in the 2021 manifesto of the SNP, the Green Party and of Scottish Labour. In 2022-23 pay policy, the Scottish Government announced a public sector pilot of a four-day week in addition to introducing flexibility for employers in order to submit a business case to trial a four-day week. And it's notable that the most significant movement in reducing working time came after PCS members overwhelmingly rejected the 2023 pay offer in the Scottish sector during the height of the cost of living crisis. As part of their supplementary pay offer to end the dispute, PCS won reductions in working time across Scottish devolved sector employers to reduce working time to 36 hours and a commitment to work with PCS to reduce working time to 35 hours with no loss of pay within the next year. The South of Scotland Enterprise pilot has now been extended until March next year, so March 2025. About 80% of the staff working there have signed a letter now supporting the four-day week, and feedback from members in Scotland has been overwhelmingly enthusiastic, with very strong support for the four-day working week to continue. At a time when there are more people of working age than ever out of work due to sickness and poor mental and physical health, anything that we can do to reduce work-related stress and illness should immediately be at least considered. Workers must benefit from technological advancements in the workplace, not just employers. So a four-day, 28-hour week is a way to realise the benefits, as Kirsten described, brought about by advances in technology and AI, without workers losing out from that. And we welcome the more enlightened comments last month by the Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds that the right to work from home can boost productivity, and we welcome the productivity, obviously, the publication rather, of the Employment Rights Bill. But it seems that under this government we can at least have a serious discussion about the world of work, where most of us currently spend about half of our working lives, and indeed about the role of trade unions within that world of work. And whilst we shouldn't conflate the four-day working week campaign with working compressed hours, it is also welcome that ministers like Angela Rayner and Baroness Jackie Smith are also now talking about rights to more flexible working. You got the impression from the last government that they saw workers very much, well, nothing more than a commodity to be used, rather than as human beings to be supported and empowered. But our message to the government and to commercial and sector employers that we represent members in is this: engage with your workforce, listen to workers coming forward with plans about how we can boost productivity, improve employee well-being and staff retention, and please be open-minded enough to pilot proposals like this and objectively monitor the results in conjunction with the trade unions who represent your staff. The people who know most about the work that they do, who know most about how to get productivity gains to, are the workers that do those jobs. So an enlightened employer will listen to their workers and their unions, including when they make the case for a four-day week. So I really welcome the opportunity to address you tonight. I'm looking forward to any discussion that we might have, and I just want to thank you very much for listening.
Fantastic. So lots of stimulating challenges, questions, thoughts. For those of you online, use the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen. Please remember to put in your name and affiliation, and if you've got any association with LSE, that's always nice to know, but we're equally happy to hear from people who haven't. For those of you in the room, I can see some hands going up already. That's fantastic. Peter, do we have anyone with a question online already? I'm going to take them in groups of three and then come to the panel to respond.
So we got a question online from Patricia Nukube, who has asked, for workers in lower socioeconomic brackets, there is a concern that four-day working week might result in compressed hours or increased pressure to complete the same workload in less time. How can we prevent this from turning into a form of exploitation where productivity is expected to increase without fair compensation?
Lovely, thank you. And then I'll take a couple from the room. Yes, please, in the back row. And please remember to just to say who you are, where you're from.
Well, from a policy perspective, the concept of work-life balance can vary for individuals. So what do you think? Would it be more effective to implement a four-day work week for all, or to rather offer employees the flexibility to choose between 5 or 6 day work week, but with shorter working hours?
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. And can we come to the middle at the front here?
Uh, Hi there. Yeah, absolutely fantastic talks. Really, really do appreciate it. My name's Avais, a sociology teacher. I remember when Corbyn proposed, like, you know, 4-day work week, people weren't taking him seriously. And even though many academics and economists wrote to the Financial Times endorsing his plans, it seems like those that deviate from the prevailing orthodoxies are not really taken too seriously, whereas Keir Starmer was seen as, you know, business as usual, very sensible grown-up politics. That's the depiction. So I was wondering, how confident are you that the architects of a policy are ready to embrace change? Or would you say, due to, you know, the turmoil we're in, AI, pandemic, etc., they'll kind of be forced to? So.
Thanks very much. Okay, so we'll come to the panel, and then I see that there are more questions in the room, and we'll certainly get some more rounds in. So compressed hours versus 4-day week, so would it effectively result in people being required to do the same work in less time? Should people be able to choose to do shorter hours but spread out over more days? And are politicians really ready to hear?
Yeah, I can kick off. Is that working? Yeah. Firstly, compressed hours isn't a 4-day week, and actually it's frustrating sometimes working on the 4-day week, because often you get headlines where it will be, say it's a 4-day week, but it's actually compressed hours, and it's just not the same thing. You know, working a 40-hour week or 37-hour week, whatever it is, over 4 days rather than five, and packing in is not really what we're trying to achieve. And in fact, actually risks exacerbating some of the problems that a true 4-day week is trying to solve in terms of burnout, stress, and overwork. So I would just say that firstly. I mean, of course, the 4-day week isn't going to solve all the problems of the economy. We do need to see wider changes. You know, the government are talking at the moment about making the minimum wage a living wage. That's going to make it much more easier for low-income workers to also benefit from things like a 4-day week. So we'll say that on that. And I guess on the question of flexibility versus a 4-day week, I mean, I do think the 4-day week is part of the flexible working agenda. However, sometimes it's frustrating because people may say that a 4-day week can be confusing sometimes, because sometimes it gets confused with compressed hours, sometimes it's a shorter working week. But actually, general flexibility is also quite confusing. You know, workers have had the right to request flexible working for a very long time, and it hasn't massively been taken up. I mean, if you look at kind of education sector and teachers, you know, it's a really, really extreme situation right now where more teachers are leaving the profession, or just as many teachers are leaving the profession as join every year, and they have the right to flexible working. So I do think, you know, we need to go further, and I would like to see a much wider rollout of the 4-day working week. And the way to do that is to set, you have a policy that is, say, you know, let's get the economy to a 4-day week in 10 years' time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. And that gives us the time for governments to work with trade union leaders, business leaders, to start making the 4-day week a reality across the economy. But maybe Fran's best place to talk about confidence with government at the moment.
Yeah. So really, three really good questions. And you know, this is a million-dollar question, isn't it? How do we bring this about? And I suppose the answer is to create a situation where there has to be a dialogue with trade unions about all of this. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that in 14 years of the previous government and the condoms before them, there was no collective bargaining at all, no genuine engagement about workers' rights within government, and that led to none of these discussions would have been taken seriously. But the fact that we're now in a position where at least one government department, well, we have a bit of leverage from what's gone on in Scotland, where we know that there's been a successful trial and that they are now using that across Scotland to try, and across other government parts of Scotland to try and consider more seriously how it can work in other employers within Scottish Government. But that, of course, then opens the door for departments like DEFRA, who, you know, have studied the evidence. As Kirsten said, you know, there's a very good case that supports all of this. We don't just pluck it out of the air. It comes from the feedback that we have directly from the staff who work to deliver this about how this could work. And then, obviously, the more dialogue you can create with the employer about all of that, the better. I mean, you know, you would expect me to say we want people to be members of a trade union, but the purpose of that is so that when we engage with the employer, we make an overwhelming case for the vast majority of the staff working there that there is a different way of doing things. And we are grappling with all the time with the balance between, you know, work, where you work, whether you work from home, whether you work in a workplace, and what the balance should be with all of that. As I say, the government across many departments now are having those discussions about how post-pandemic everybody is working differently. But it just seems a logical next step now in terms of all the other discussions that take place around flexible working, that this is something that's considered. And, you know, as I said when I spoke, we want a pilot, we want a trial. We're not seeking to move to this overnight. Nobody's naive and thinks that the government's just going to say, OK, let's do this tomorrow. But if we can set out to achieve steps towards it in you know, you said 10 years, maybe sooner, you know, then that's all for the good. But really what we need to start all of this is people coming forward with positive examples about how it can work, the realisation that actually the sky doesn't cave in and the world doesn't collapse because people work a four-day week, and in fact there are some real gains to be made from that. So I think it's a really good time to have that discussion and to start to create a genuine dialogue about how people can work differently and still deliver the same outcomes. So thank you.
Thanks. Kirsty, I don't know if you want to come in, but particularly on the point about inequalities in the labour market and whether this would turn into another form of exploitation of the most disadvantaged workers.
Yes, that, and I also wanted to tie it into the issue of the fact that we don't really at the moment have very good information on any of this. So the key thing about working flexibly is that it shouldn't be a one-way street, so it shouldn't just be like a zero-hour contract where the employer mandates when you have to come in and how often and so on. So the big question is, how do you then regulate this? So if you think back to your traditional employment contract, which was open-ended, regular working week, you had a single identifiable employer, and we all know that what those jobs used to be like. Well, every year there's fewer of them. And so what people are doing now is that, you know, they're working part-time or independently or a combination of sort of situations. And one of the things that the government has to think about, it's not just about the employer and the worker. We have to generate a model that's sustainable over the long term. So, for example, a zero-hour contract may be a very efficient way of regulating workflow or labour supply, and it may also be what a particular worker wants because they don't want to be working full-time, etc. But the reality is that a zero-hour contract contributes less to our national insurance, pays less in taxes, contributes less consistently to our welfare state. And also we know that people on zero-hour contracts often also are higher recipients of help from that welfare state, both in terms of healthcare, pension supplements or income benefits and so on. So we have to ensure that the system over the long run is sustainable, because the ideal situation is not where everyone is flexible through mechanisms of contract that are then cheaper. We have to do this in a way that ensures that we are sustaining our welfare state. And it should never be cheaper to be on a precarious contract than it is to be on a long-term, stable and open-ended one. And at the moment, we have the exact opposite of the situation. It's much cheaper to hire somebody on some form of precarious, outsourced, self-employed, etc. contract than it is to have them on a regular, open-ended contract. And so any thought that we put into this process of thinking how we can implement a four-day working week has to bear that in mind. We need to, I think, fundamentally rethink how we are organising our labour force, our workforce, our welfare state, our labour market.
Brilliant, thank you. We've got another question online, I think.
So we have one question online who asks about migrant workers who are often concentrated in precarious sectors such as care work, cleaning and hospitality, where they face low wages and unstable contracts. So how do you think the introduction of a four-day working week would affect these people? And how can we ensure that they don't experience job insecurity or exploitation as a result?
Thank you very much. And then if we can go back here, please.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talks, especially because I actually work 4 days a week, not a contract. And I was just kind of curious about, again, how you define it. Because if I don't work, I don't get paid. So I'm more than happy to work 5 days a week on many, many times. But also, I was just curious, Joe, when you were talking about the number of applications that went up when 4 days a week. But I feel like that's a, I don't say disingenuous, but that's, I mean, I think that's great for that. But when I was job hunting not too long ago, and regular jobs for 5 days a week were getting 100, 200 applications on LinkedIn. So I really don't think it matters that they're 4 days a week or not. And my final point is that while I think that I do love the concept of 4 days a week, I'm in PR and communications, and that's just not the way the world works. If a journalist is calling, and I work for a pharmaceutical company, and saying we want comment, I can't just say, no, it's Friday, I don't work. That just, it's not the reality of the world. So I think that this is a very good idea for some industries, but in the 24-hour news cycle, it just doesn't make any sense.
Thanks very much, and to this gentleman here.
Thanks very much. My name's Tim Nolan. I'm just a member of the public. I should also just preface it by saying I'm a huge advocate of the four-day week, and I'm delighted to see the change of government. However, I think it'd be fair to say the vast majority of business leaders, business owners, and so forth, whether they be in the private or public sector, are also workers themselves. And I don't think people wake up in the morning deliberately trying to harm fellow workers, or the vast majority of people don't. So I think, given what we've heard today, it's clearly there's a pretty good empirical case for this. So what are the real barriers that we have to overcome to convince people? Because I suspect many people in the room are convinced, but frankly, we're not probably the key decision makers. And is one of those perhaps a slight scepticism that a lot of the benefits shown, such as retention and such as satisfaction, which I've no doubt are true in the short to medium term, would be eroded if we were all on a four-day week? They're a comparative advantage. So no wonder you get 500% people rushing to Atom if they're the only game in town that's four-day week. If we were all four-day week, you've just levelled the playing field, albeit at a better level, but it is still levelled. So a lot of those benefits may erode over time. But fundamentally, what are the blockers that we need to overcome?
Fantastic. Okay, so I'm going to come back to the panel now. We've got a question about migrant workers. We've got a question about what happens, how do you get coverage of the week for those industries and businesses, services that need to cover the full week if everyone's working to a four-day week, and what are the barriers to actually moving to introduce it? Should I come to you again?
Yeah, Jeremy? Just to kick off, sure. I mean, if we're talking about a four-day week being implemented nationally across the whole country, it actually could solve a much wider problem that we have, which is that we have millions of workers that are underemployed, that don't have enough work. At the same time, we have millions of workers that are overemployed, they have too much work. And so if implemented at a much more national level with government involvement, there is an argument that it could be used to rebalance work across the economy. So those that actually don't have enough work can go up to 4 days a week, those that are on 2 days a week, 3 days a week. So there is that argument. But I would also say that the fact that there's insecurity in the economy and that people are on 0 hours contracts, that's not a problem of the 4 day week. They're separate issues. They need sorting out, and hopefully the government will ban 0 hours contracts, but we'll see. I think on the terms of job applications, I mean, we know from working with various flexible working organisations that perhaps there is just a lot of competition at the moment for all jobs. But we know that 4 day weeks and flexible working and all the kind of HR surveys, so they are more popular in terms of the amount of people applying. And that, to answer the point about what do you do on a Friday when a journalist calls, well, as loads of four-day week companies have already done, they just rotate their days off. So rather than everyone having a Friday off, for example, at South Cambridgeshire District Council, half the staff have work Mondays to Thursdays and half the staff work Tuesdays to Fridays. So there are ways of doing it, and it can be implemented in that way so that it's flexible. Barriers that we need to overcome, I mean, there are longer-term studies now, and I agree, we still need... It's still quite early days, so that evidence will emerge. But the studies that are out there, and some of these are tracking hundreds of companies that have moved to a four-day week all over the world since the trials have taken place, still getting really positive results years later. And actually, working hours continuing to reduce even further, and the company still benefiting, and everyone's going to still continue. I know on that pilot in 2022, we did a kind of follow-up study, and virtually all of them still doing a four-day week. So that evidence will start to emerge. And actually, we have a study out on Friday, at the Autonomy Institute does, looking at Iceland, who are one of the biggest countries to move to a four-day week on a much larger scale. And that shows that I think 60% of workers in Iceland, which is hundreds of thousands of workers, have moved to a shorter working week, some of them doing 4 day weeks. down to at least 35 hours, and their economy is actually outperforming compared to most of the rest of Europe. So that study's out on Friday.
I'm sorry, we need to come back to the rest of the panel, and then in time we'll come back to you. Kirsty.
I just wanted to, trying to tie in these questions a little bit, with regard to one important issue is that people who are self-employed, the government, they are self-employed, so it'd be very difficult for the government to come in and say, thou shalt not work 5 days. However, what the government can regulate is it can ensure that people who are self-employed are actually genuinely self-employed and not just actually dependent on an employer. And a big issue there is the gig economy, where we have just, we've got the very odd situation that Uber drivers are workers, but Bolt drivers aren't. These inconsistencies, so our labour market and our regulation is full of these inconsistencies. The other thing I just wanted to throw out there is that as we think about this, I think it's also worth thinking about some of the other issues that are tied into the labour market. And what I like to sort of say is that the labour market is the foundation for many other things, not just our welfare state, but also, for example, the educational results of our children often is related to the employment situation of their parents. So there's evidence for the fact that children with parents who have stable jobs with reasonable incomes and so on, and who aren't breaking their backs working in 5 different jobs, they perform better at school. Parents will have more time on a 4-day working week to spend with their children to help them improve their educational outcomes or other things. So I would imagine that with an experiment like this, all sorts of other socioeconomic indicators will also improve, and the benefits of that are probably at least as great as the actual labour market benefits that we've seen from the study. So I think that's something that we need to bear in mind in all of these aspects. Just something to... Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I mean, some really, again, really interesting points, but I want to focus on this thing about migrant workers, because I think when people think about the civil service, they assume that most people are directly employed by government, but the CS of PCS is the commercial sector, so people that would have been civil servants had their work not been privatised. Now, clearly, when people bid for those contracts, they're government contracts, so they would be companies like, let's give an example, G4S, ISS, OCS, a number of companies that bid for a lot of government work, you would assume that there were some basic minimum standards that would apply, like trade union recognition, like the payment of sick pay, like the minimum wage. None of those things are currently true. And under the previous government, there were obviously... They had an ideology that suited them in terms of giving more of those contracts to their mates. And I would like to say that they would award them to the highest bidder, but in fact, they awarded to the lowest bidder. So often the companies that won the contracts were paying well below the minimum wage. And what that has led to over a period of time is the only way those companies can make a profit is then to exploit the workforce. So... we are starting from a low bar in terms of employment rights in this country. So whatever we think about the new government and whether the Employment Rights Bill goes far enough, it has to be better than what we've had before, and actually potentially is the most transformative bit of legislation in 45 years. So there is a lot to welcome in terms of some of the commitments that, if they honour them, and that's always the big if, isn't it? But if they follow through on the commitments that they have made around the Employment Rights Bill, that will lead to significant changes. But of course, all of that has to be considered in the context that what you don't want is to get a 4-day week, but then, as you say, pay below the minimum wage. So it might surprise you to know that in the civil service itself, so those directly employed by government, tens of thousands of our lowest grades are now in receipt of universal credit. Many of them are paid beneath the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So in April every year, they have an enforced uplift just for the government, who is their employer, to be able to remain within the law. And so... the government that's just come in has a huge task to address in terms of all of that. So I think the discussion has to start somewhere. I think, you know, when you think about, you know, probably Joe will put me right in terms of the year that all this happened, but when there were first proposals about people not working all weekend, there was probably shock horror about how a business is going to survive. But in fact now, it is an acceptance that a lot of people don't work at weekends. And so, as trade unionists, we always push for try and find improvements for our members in terms of pay, terms and conditions. But that is a massive debate that now needs to take place. And you know, clearly, we've got a keen interest in what Labour have said about insourcing and what they described in their manifesto as the biggest wave of insourcing in a generation. Well, we haven't seen it yet, and it's not in the Employment Rights Bill announcements that they've made. So we need to see some of that happen in order to protect those migrant workers, but actually in order to make the case that in a lot of instances, I mean, I can genuinely say in the civil service, there has never been a good privatisation, and a lot of those privatisations then lead to costing the taxpayer more in the long run, because actually the contracts that have been, you know, awarded end up failing, and then the taxpayer has to bail out the companies that have been awarded the contract. So there's a big dialogue to be had about the world of work more generally, about employment rights, about migrant workers, about job protection. But I think the four-day week and other flexibilities has to form part of that dialogue now. And I hope that what this, you know, discussions like this can only lead to more people making the case, and that's important. Thank you.
We've got another question online, I think, and then we'll go just behind to there. Thank you.
So we've got a question from Donny Adebiyi, who's a visitor at LSE, who asked, although the majority of the companies that took part in the study stuck with the four-day week, regarding the sectors that didn't, do you have any details on why they might have chose to opt out and any limitations that they had regarding the nature of their work?
Thanks very much. And then just behind you.
Hi there, my name is DJ. I work in the Office for National Statistics. Kirsten, you mentioned the Labour Force survey earlier, and you said that it wasn't so great at measuring workforce efficiency. I was just wondering, what would you do to measure workforce efficiency more effectively, and what's maybe missing? Thank you.
Thanks very much. And then at the back here, please.
Adrian Farina, I'm an alumni of LSE. I'm going back to a question that, I mean, we've touched a bit on that, which is on workers. So I see the application on white collar or just jobs that where there's a lot of room for efficiency, a lot of waste and time to go into meetings and travel, all of that. But back to these more manual jobs. So there's a case in the study of the fast food chain that, again, more motivated worker sells more chips and therefore more revenue for them. But I doubt that that would lead the company to shut the restaurant down because they're happy with the increased revenue. So the point is, the restaurant still needs to be open 7 days a week. And if someone is now asked to work only 4 days a week, that person will suffer with their wages. So all the jobs that are directly related to time, delivery, fast food, whatever, I mean, a pump. So how
okay, thanks very much. So if we can try and keep our answers short, then we might get another round in before we finish, because there's still people who want to ask questions. Joe, anything about the companies that didn't stick with it? And then Kirsty, a direct question on the Labour Force survey.
Yeah, I'll just be very quickly on that. There was only a couple of companies that didn't stick with it. A few of them actually went on to do a 4.5-day week, so weren't quite ready to do a full 4-day week. There was one company where it really didn't work, and that was largely down to the fact that they just didn't have enough staff in the first place. So we wouldn't really recommend doing a 4-day week trial if your operation isn't working as it is. You know, they were just struggling to get the staff to do the work anyway. So it's a bad place to start in terms of moving to a 4-day week. So that was the reason they suffered. And they did say actually they would look again at it in the future. But there was no like real disasters that stood out in that.
Yes, thanks for that question on the ONS and the Labour Force survey. So there's a couple of things. The basic questionnaire measures some very basic variables about employment conditions, for example, what type of contract you have, whether you want to work more hours or less, that kind of thing. but really not very many. So there's nothing in there, for example, about the work intensity, how autonomously you work, whether you have control over the hours you work, when you work, all of that, those variables that normally would be part of an employment conditions survey aren't in there. You can't do that with the survey as it is at the moment, but we are also no longer part of the European Working Conditions Survey, and we don't have a UK alternative. So we're not gathering data on this frequently enough, and not with samples that are big enough. And the one area where the UK just hasn't made enough progress is in linking up admin data and then interviewing the people, a subsample of the admin data. And this is just to pique you a little, having lived in Chile and worked there for 20 years, I went from manual printouts in data archives that I had to put into an Excel spreadsheet to linked admin data online in 20 years. And we have fallen so far behind on that in the UK, but also in some other countries in Europe. So it can be done. We really need to think about that, because at the moment we have a very partial understanding of how our labour market works, and in that information gap, everyone just has opinions and not evidence.
Thanks. And who'd like to take the question about?
Didn't really catch the question.
Joe, do you want to come in?
I can try and address that. Yeah.
The economics of it.
Yeah, of course. I'm not going to sit here and say I know exactly how every single job is going to move to a four-day week. I don't. However, I mean, the first thing to say on this is that I do really believe that workers are owed a four-day week, that we have had significant productivity gains in all sorts of industries, including manufacturing sector, over the last few decades. If you think about the technological advances, they're huge. So firstly, I do think workers are owed a four-day week. This is long overdue. But on the pilot, I mean, the few manufacturing companies that did it were interesting. The brewery, actually, I remember working with, and they really looked at every single task that everyone was doing in the brewery. They're all on the shop floor, they're making beers, and actually trained up everyone to do every task. So by the end of it, everyone could do every single task in the brewery, and they just did find those efficiencies. So that's part of the answer. I mean, if you take the construction sector, for example, I guess part of it is also that the argument is different in different sectors, and implementation will look different. I mean, we did a report into the construction sector, and that's actually a sector where people are not only burnt out, but they're physically exhausted. You get to, and a lot of the builders we interviewed for the project, they all said it gets to Friday afternoon. To be honest, we're not doing much on a Friday afternoon on a building site, and my brother works on a building site, and he confirmed that. But I think that the arguments are different. In something like a construction sector, there's long-term benefits to being better rested in terms of being able to better physical health. And one of the problems in that sector is that workers actually retire really early because they're just knackered, their bodies are knackered, they can't work anymore. So I think it's going to look different in each industry. And there's been some surprising examples as well. I mean, there's lots of companies that have moved to 4-day week that have kind of customer service based, and they have to answer the phones 24/7. And they've actually found that their staff are dealing with calls much more efficiently, much more effectively. And by being more smart and strategic with the kind of rota and shift patterns, which you already have anyway in lots of jobs, you can get to a 4-day week with people having different day offs. Maybe some people have a Monday off, maybe some people have a Wednesday off. So it will look different in each sector.
Thank you very much, and thanks for keeping your answers brief. So we'll go over here first, please.
Hello, I'm Isabel. I'm just a sixth form student doing economics, and I was wondering if you think that this has any applications in, say, secondary schools. Do you think that it will be possible for students studying GCSEs and A-levels to move towards a four-day working week as well?
Great question. And as the parent of a 15-year-old doing their GCSEs, I'm right with you on that. At the back here, please.
I just had a quick question on the sort of wider implications of a four-day week. You talked about, Joe, about the environmental impacts that a four-day week could have, and I'm just wondering, if it does have environmental benefits, should the four-day week be part of our move to a more sustainable way of living?
Thank you very much. And did I say there was a question here?
Hi, I'm an LSE guest teacher, and I also run a policy management piece of policy and well-being management. I'm curious about some of the environmental impacts from the four-day week. We found that poor well-being and competence among management and just poor relationships with managers is a real driver behind kind of high levels of stress and burnout and ultimately turnover. Does the four-day week need to be supplemented with this, or do managers suddenly develop that competence for their worst?
Thanks very much. So super quick answers from the panel. Fran, maybe come to you on the question of poor relationships with managers.
And I think there's a long way to go, isn't there, in terms of how we address that. Clearly, as a trade union, people don't come to us generally when they're blissfully happy. They come to us when they have concerns about those relationships, and we do a lot of work to try and build positive engagement, and clearly the start to all of this is having that dialogue, having that engagement, and as many people as possible getting involved in the conversation. But I think you make some really important points, and it's not a given that relationships are always going to be positive, and clearly depending where you work, there's a long way to go in some places to improve all of that. And I think the dialogue more generally about the world of work is important, and one that hopefully everybody will want to be involved in, whether they do that as a manager or as a member of staff that's subject to the terms and conditions. So, yeah, I think the stuff about poor relationships is something we're acutely aware of in our line of business, for want of a better phrase, and it's something that we have to work to seek to address, and that's what we do. Thank you.
Thank you. Kirsty, I'll come to you, and then Jo the final word.
Yeah, I've been asked to do the environmental question. So I think there's some very obvious environmental shifts that could come out of this, but then others that are very much, much harder to estimate. So the obvious one is reduced circulation. If everyone stays at home for one day, we've probably actually already seen that from COVID, and so we can estimate what the impact of that would be based on that COVID process. But there's also the rethinking of our work processes. So of course, not every worker can stay at home or work from home. So other sectors where you actually have to circulate, delivery, for example, would be one of them. And if you're rethinking all of your work processes in order to fit your tasks into 4 days instead of five, it probably means that you will put some tasks together. So reroute your deliveries, or like Amazon already does, when you order something, it will ask, would you prefer fewer deliveries, or do you mind waiting an extra day? Savings that come from that. Within those work processes, you have you're spending a lot of energy as well, so that could be potentially reduction. So think about it, if you have your computer on and you are typing an email, how long that takes, and how long does it take if you have a reliable dictation software that can do that email in a fraction of the time. At the end of the day, you will get more done in the same time, or your computer will be on for less, so that there would be sort of energy savings from processes like this. But I think it's probably one of the harder things to predict, because the best we have to go on at the moment is COVID, or actually the experiment itself, and to extrapolate from there to the economy and the environment as a whole is much, much harder. But it's probably one of the another positive externality from an experiment like this.
Couple of words on schools.
I mean, I absolutely do believe that both teachers and kids should have a 4 day week, and that's where the 5 day week gloom begins, isn't it? When we all go to school, I really, and actually, there's in the last couple of months, we've had at least 20 schools have moved to a 9 day fortnight for teachers, and there's a handful of schools that are starting to look at 4 day weeks as well. At the moment, the kids are allowed to come in on a Friday for extracurricular activities or to catch up on homework, but they're kind of up to them. And I do think that's where we're headed. So we're starting to think about prioritising the education sector a bit more and starting to think about a bigger pilot next year. I think there's an obvious case for teachers. I mean, they're so burnt out, it's ridiculous. Something needs to happen. It's just going to break. The whole system's going to break. But for kids, it's a slightly different argument. And I do think there's strong arguments around actually kids benefiting from more time playing, less time in the in a classroom. But I think we're not quite there yet, the conversation. I think we need to start moving more in that direction, because I absolutely think kids should have a four-day week as well as teachers.
Thank you very much. Thanks indeed. Okay, so we're going to bring proceedings to a close here. I want to thank Fran Heathcote. I want to thank Kirsty Zanebrook. I want to thank Jo Ryle for their excellent comments and stimulation this evening. This is the book that's available just outside as you leave, and Joe's going to be here if you want to get us his signature. You're welcome to come back in and have a further chat with Jo there as well. Thank you very much, audience in the room. Thank you, audience online. I'm hoping that there were some LSE senior managers, decision makers in the room or online who've been listening very carefully to the arguments and the convincing case, I think, for the four-day week. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.